This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello and welcome to episode 41 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. So it's been a while since I've done a podcast. I think it's been a little over a month and change, maybe closer to 2 months. One of the big reasons that I took time off was I was working on Push the Lane, and I had this crazy idea. I had this situation with Oro where the game took 6 years to make, and I'm kind of always feeling like, you know, I'm at the mercy of waiting for other people, usually programmers, or, you know, it's mostly programmers because I'm mostly working with like donated time. I haven't been a programmer in the past. I've talked a little bit about that, but these days I am enough of a programmer where I can do my own stuff on my own. And so things kind of came together. I was, my day job is usually doing pixel art for other people's indie games. And this summer, I had a job lined up, and then it kind of fell through. And so I was like, well, I can afford to just spend like all of July pretty much just working. And I did that. The entire month of July, I streamed, actually most of it, a lot of it you can still find on my Twitch channel. And I just streamed and streamed and streamed. And I seriously went like, you know, most days was like 8 or 9 hours a day. A few days, I think my record was like 13 or 14 hours somewhere in there in a day. So like really just working like crazy. It was really, very intense. And I made some serious progress. And I mean, at this point I have a game that is like playable, and we're going to talk about Push the Lane a lot, today. Let's get into some of the nitty gritty details of the design stuff. Just up front, I'm going to giving you the backstory of what's going on and where I've been, and I guess some sort of housekeeping. So yeah, you know, I've been working on Push the Lane. We'll come back to that, of course, but I made some serious progress. I originally intended to release the game by the end of the summer, and you know, I could have done that. I could have scrambled in the last few weeks of August, and I could have put something together and released it. That would have been possible, but it wouldn't have been great. It would have been kind of bad, actually. I think trying to make a game more or less from scratch, now it's kind of interesting. We'll get into the Push the Lane stuff a little bit later, but I'll come back to that. So a couple other news things. I've been working on Push the Lane. The last couple of weeks I sort of stopped. I just needed to step away from it a little bit. I wasn't burned out, but it's one of those things where you should probably step away before you get burned out, which I feel like is what I did. So other big news, I am going to be speaking at this year's Indiecade in Los Angeles this year. I have a talk that I'm working on now, I'm writing it now, about single-player games, single-player strategy games specifically, and how we can use that medium. And, you know, it's going to be talking a little bit about, you know, toxicity in games and how we can make games that are sort of humane and, make people feel included and not threatened and are welcoming to people. And yet make them strategy games. So that's like really kind of the big question that I'll be addressing. And I'm pretty excited for it. I'm in the early phases of writing the talk, but I hope that I'll be able to record it. And if I'm not, I'll probably record it later and at least release it for patrons. So yeah, and the Patreon is going really well. I've got a couple, two or three new patrons over the summer, which is really great. Really helps a lot. Actually, I got one $50 patron, which really, really helps. I mean, that's almost 50% of what I was making before. So, and his name is Jean-Marc Neely. So I want to say thank you to him especially. And as always, if you want to support this show, if you enjoy the stuff I do, please do consider becoming a patron. Even just a couple bucks will get you access to early builds of things, early drafts. I might run this talk by patrons, or at least part of it. things like that, you know, you kind of get more of a behind the scenes look. And not only that, but, you know, you obviously help support someone who's making something that hopefully you value. So, yeah, back to the podcast, this podcast itself. I've been doing a lot of guest podcasts recently. This episode, there is no guest. It's just going to be me, kind of a classic Clockwork Game Design episode, I suppose. So I'm going to talk about Push the Lane a bunch. I'm going to talk about indie game development in general. I'm going to talk a little bit. Well, right now, I'm also going to give you a quick little heads up on a few other news items. Dino Farm is going through some changes again. I know we've been doing this over and over and over again, but I think we're still sort of like in the process of coping with, you know, with the realities of being an indie in this age of having worked on a game like Oro for 6 years and having it not really necessarily pay off the way that we were hoping, and various other things. But we have news coming up for Dino Farm, and so stay tuned to that. Dino Farm also has its own podcast. We're going to be recording a new episode of that tomorrow. So stay tuned on the Dino Farm Patreon or the Dino Farm website for news on that. That'll be up hopefully tomorrow. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit first about these last couple of months, really July 2017 and August 2017. More July. July was like wall to wall. I was like, I wonder if any human being on the planet spent more hours doing game development, or let's say just streaming game development, in the month of July 2017 than I did. You know, maybe there's like 10 in the world, but I don't think there was that many. It was pretty intense, but I don't know, maybe there's some like whole world of like people who just work for 16 hours a day every day. I don't know. Anyways, it was seriously intense. And one of the things that kind of like struck me and started to sort of be a tax on my life is, you know, when you work that much, there's like costs on your life. You know, I didn't clean up. I didn't like, you know, do like not chores. I didn't like, you know, just take care of life things. Not to mention like, you know, working and stuff. So, you know, there's a literal cost to it. But also, I mean, you know, there's a social cost. I didn't really hang out with people. I didn't really spend time with people that are like important to me. And so there's, in a way, you know, there's a few people that come by the stream and stuff, and I have this Discord channel where I'm chatting with people, but like, you know, a lot of those, I mean, that's more than nothing. And I think that sort of allowed me to isolate myself even more, actually, because like I was saying at the time, I was like, you know, man, this is really great because it sort of, it doesn't feel as like lonely when you're streaming, because like technically there's like one or two people watching you sort of. So you can kind of like hack your loneliness a little bit, but like, actually it's, you know, you're not really making any connections with people really. Not that I love the people who come by the stream. They're really cool, some of them. And, I would love to be closer friends with some of them. However, I'm not, you know, I'm not like really close friends with any of these people. And so like the people who are my real close friends and family and stuff, you know, I didn't see them or talk to them or anything. And so that's not a huge deal. It's a month, you know, but it's something to think about. And it kind of feeds into these larger topics that I've been thinking about a lot over the last year or so, about like antisocial tendencies, and how in many ways I've learned and adapted to be antisocial in all sorts of ways. Sort of, I've established patterns of thinking that tend to push people away from myself, and this feeds a little bit into my theory and my my game design work. Not necessarily my game designs, although I think there too it is visible. 100 Rogues is pretty accessible. I think that was my first game. That was before I really knew like what I wanted to do. I didn't have a strong idea of what good game design would be like, really. I mean, I had some ideas, but they were mostly just, you know, inherited sort of vestigial ideas. It was really by, I guess, Empire and 100 and Oro that I was like really like starting to develop my theories. And, you know, I wrote my first book, and by the time I wrote my second book, it was 2015. That's Clockwork Game Design, the book that gave this podcast its name. I really had solidified these theories of game design, of strategy game design, how to understand interactive systems, all that kind of stuff. And I'm, you know, I don't disavow any of that. I think that is all correct, useful. I'm going to talk later in this episode itself about how I'm specifically using that stuff. But I also think there's another motive there and another effect that I didn't really fully grasp until this summer. So the other big thing that some of my theory does, certainly a lot of my critical analysis and just the way that I approach media in general does, is it pushes people away. I thought a lot about like how a lot of game developers, they have like a community, a larger community that they're a part of. So like, you know, one that comes to mind is David Serlin. He's like a member of the fighting game community, and now he's making a fighting game. And so people in the fighting game community automatically are, you know, attaching to him. And I remember actually back in the day in like high school and early college that I was a musician and I played in bands and stuff. And I remember there were like these punk bands and there was a punk scene and you could make a punk band and then you would automatically have this community, this larger community of punk fans who would like at least maybe partially be your fan, like sort of automatically because they already have this association. Whereas my music was like just totally eclectic and all over the place. And, you know, like my thinking was like, well, the Beatles are like this. And, you know, lots of bands that I like are Queen is like this. Like they have all kinds of weird songs and they can't really be classified. And that's fine. And, you know, on some level, it is fine. But the thing is that I now have like started to realize that like part of the reason that I did that was for the weird side effect of pushing people away, because like, you know, that sort of insulates you to some extent. Like when you do things that you on some level know will alienate people or that people will find strange and not know how to understand, you know, like if they don't like it or they don't get it, it doesn't hurt as much. Like, you know, it's them rejecting you is like, well, you can just say like, well, they just didn't get it. And I mean, in fact, that's, you know, that is how I think of Oro. Like, I do think that Oro is a strong system and that people just don't get it largely. And part of that is because we don't teach the game properly, but part of it is that it's a weird game. There's no game that's like Oro. You know, like if we made a Civ-like game or if we made a fighting game, we could say this is like Street Fighter. This is like Civilization. But with Oro, if we say it's like roguelikes, people are going to be like very alienated. If we say it's like, I don't know, like what? It's like puzzle games. People are going to be very alienated. It's very different than other things. And, you know, in some abstract sort of academic way of looking at art and stuff, that's good. Like, that's a good quality. That's cool because you're expressing who you really are and, you know, you're not conforming and you're creating some really, truly new thing. And that's, I do think that's all cool and good. However, there's something to be said on the other side. There's something to be said for trying to connect with people. And this is obviously, you know, I mean, we've always thought, this is not a new thought, that, you know, accessibility, that we want to make games that people will understand, that people will like, that people will connect with. However, it's kind of complicated because I've always wanted to make games that people would connect with, but on some level, you know, like what you want, there's, people have multiple motivations going on. They're not always totally aware of all their motivations. And I think what I've discovered about myself is that I've had other motivations than besides just wanting to make accessible, deep, interesting games. I think that I've had a motivation to push people away. And that comes through in my work, my design work, my, you know, writing and all that kind of stuff. But it also comes through in my media analysis. When I, you know, I started doing this series called Hit Scan. And I've only made two episodes of it. I'm not quite sure if I'm going to continue with that series or not. I like making it, but, you know, between these thoughts and between other things going on in my life, I just don't know if I'll have time or if it's a priority. But either way, the point is, I made two episodes. One was on the show Stranger Things, which everybody loves. I don't love it, but I do know that everybody loves it. And, you know, I felt compelled to go out of my way to, like, I mean, like, I wouldn't say nitpick, but I think a lot of people would say nitpick the show. That's what I did in that series, is that I like took it scene by scene, line by line. And I actually find that kind of stuff interesting. Like, I like hearing about analysis of, you know, like screenwriting and all that kind of stuff. I think that's interesting, and I like to watch that kind of stuff. But I also think there's another motivation there too, which is like, hey, this thing that you like, guess what? I don't like it. Get the hell away from me. You know what I mean? I'm not consciously thinking that, but that's just something that's going on there. So anyway, this whole idea of like sort of pushing people away has been really on the front of my mind recently. And I feel like it kind of like came to a head in some weird ways this July with that month of game development. Like, it's something I've always done, and I've never really been completely aware of it. So anyway, that's informing my stuff going forward a lot. You know, how can I, like, looking at art a little bit differently. So I want to talk a little bit about formalism and you know, art in the way that I've always talked about art. You know, sort of the David Deutsch style of thinking about beauty and all that kind of thing. You know, maybe there are, as David Deutsch would say, like, you know, formal, like testable, true, absolute qualities of what is beautiful. I like David Deutsch's idea that, you know, things that are beautiful are things that like really inform you, that actually communicate something. And the thing that the opposite of beautiful is not ugly, but rather boring, something that doesn't tell you much. And I think that's all true. And I think there's a lot to think about there. And that's all, you know, and my work is mostly in how do we make better systems. So that inherently suggests that, you know, that there is some objectivity, there is some like absolute truth value to one system being stronger than another. And I think that's, you know, I mean, at least on the small tactical level, like, you know, issuing patch notes and stuff like that, that's undeniably true. I mean, for a given system, you know, you can tweak one thing and it's very obvious when it makes it worse. Or almost all the time, it's very obvious. There are times when you're deceived. There's times when you're wrong and, you know, you get it wrong, whatever. But in general, I do think that, you know, systems and artworks, you know, there is a actual skill to them. I'm not throwing that out. I'm not becoming like a postmodern whatever, you know, everything is valuable just because someone made it type of thinker. However, I do think that art's purpose is not just about like creating this mathematically or logically sound set of arguments and expressing this information to someone. I think that art also has another purpose of connecting. It's saying, hey, I see the world this way. Do you see the world this way too? You know, on some level about something. And when you say, yes, I do see it that way a little bit, or I totally see it that way, you make a connection. You know, you become a little bit closer to that person. To say yes to someone, to say, yes, I see it the way you see it, makes you a little bit closer to that person. And art is an opportunity to do that. Art is like we're holding a lens to some part of reality. We're saying, we're putting a little picture frame around it, and we're saying, hey, you see that? Do you see that too? Do you see that shape in the sky? Those clouds up there? Do you think that looks like a turtle? I think it looks like a turtle. Do you think it does? And if they say yes, it's like you feel a little bit closer. And in some sense, you probably are a little bit closer. And that is one of the functions of art. And I've just been sort of realizing how important it is. You know, I mean, we're social animals. It's very important that we learn to connect with each other. And, you know, this has been informed by my whole venture into politics and sociology and social justice and all that kind of stuff as well. You know, in sort of social justice movements, particularly in media, there's this idea of like representation and having good representation of people. So you don't want everyone to just be like a white straight dude, right? You want many different body types. You want different gender representations. You want expressions. You want you know, old people, young people, people who have disabilities. Like, you want to portray a large variety of people in your games, and that's one thing. Is to just do that. But there's another thing to it, which is, you know, actually challenging your beauty standards Because I think like a lot of people like myself who grow up with the media that I grew up with tend to think that, you know, white, young, skinny, able-bodied is just inherently more attractive qualities than, you know, dark-skinned, fatter, that kind of thing, you know, non-white. So anyway, there's all this stuff. And you know, and the idea, though, is to not just be like, oh, well, yeah, white people are better looking, but I'm going to put in a black person just because, like, I want to do a good social justice thing. Like, the better thing to do is, like, actually challenge your standards of what is beautiful. Like, why do you think white people are more beautiful than black people? I think that's something that, you know, not many people would say they think, but I do think that, you know, it's hard to deny that in our culture and our media atmosphere, it's very hard to deny that people are generally pushed in the direction of thinking that way. So, you know, there's this idea of challenging your own beauty standards in that sense. And I think that applies to all art. That applies to many things because like I said, like part of the objective of art is to, learn to connect with people, to expand your horizons of kinds of people and kinds of positions and points of view that you could understand and connect with. And so I think that while some things are absolutely true, some things are absolute truths about, especially when you get into like, you know, mechanical relationships with which games, you know, especially strategy games are highly mechanical and they're, you know, you can build a better car, you can build a better bridge, and you can build a better game. Like there is an engineering problem aspect to it. But there is also, and actually I would say even just in the sort of art aesthetic design philosophy, there is a sort of engineering aspect to that as well. However, there is also this other aspect of, you know, learning to connect with people and learning to see things the way that other people see things. And so in that lens, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, how we think about people and beauty standards and all that kind of stuff and thinking about, you know, like critical analysis standards for art. Like, what do we consider good art, you know, and what do we consider a good craft? And I think that those need to be looked at, you know, with a little bit more of a wide angle lens, looking at it, you know, a little bit more through a historical lens and, you know, realizing that we are looking at it from a very particular perspective at a very particular point in time, that we're not these like rational robots, that I have a very unique perspective as, you know, a white straight guy living in New York of the United States and in 2017. Like that's a very particular perspective, and I, you know, I need to keep that in mind, that like when I say that I don't know, somebody's perspective is wacky in their drawing or somebody's voice leading is bad in their composition, that I am, you know, some of those standards, those again like beauty standards, some of them might be kind of partially true, and some of them might be just, you know, my upbringing, my cultural background, and my, you know, all those kind of things that have given me, you could say, a bias in some sense. But actually, it's not really a bias. It's just, I mean, it's just people, you know, that kind of stuff. That's another big change, is that I used to think that, you know, your personal background, like where you, how you grew up, like the friends you made, the experience you had as a kid, all that kind of stuff. I used to think of that stuff as noise, whereas the signal was the true good art, the true composition. And whereas now I'm just like, actually, though, all those things, all that I thought were noise are not noise. That's life. That's like reality. That is, they are all based on real things. They're not magical. They're not random. They're sort of random in a sense, but they are real. They're based on real things that have happened to you and that real experiences that you've had. And they actually reflect the real person that you are. So to say that they are noise is like itself a horribly antisocial view, because it's kind of just saying that human beings are noise, that like we want this like robot universe of no differences of opinion, no, you know, like no sort of different points of view, different personalities, different experiences. We just want like this one robot brain that just sees everything exactly the same way. And, you know, so it's, and, you know, maybe there is some weird way in which you could argue that the one robot brain is superior to humanity, but it's not humanity. You know, humanity is, it is the other thing. It's all these, this noise, I'm saying noisy in a different sense, like noisy as in like, you know, a cacophony of sounds and different people yelling at each other and yelling over each other and disagreeing and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. I'm thinking about Frank Lance, who I've had on the podcast a couple times. And, you know, I think he's tried to say this kind of stuff to me before in various ways, and it didn't necessarily resonate in the past. But yeah, and I think that other people have tried to say these kinds of things before. And a lot of times it would ring to me as this postmodern, you know, elliptical kind of like, I would say spam in the past. And some of it probably was. I mean, some of it is like, you know, some people are kind of just full of shit. Like, I'm not going to deny that, you know. But here's the thing, like even when people are kind of, you know, full of shit or making stuff up or trying to insert noise, random nonsense into their conversation, you still are getting information about them, like by what kind of random nonsense they're choosing to say. So, anyways, that's kind of a big thing. That's informing my game design thoughts. It's informing my theory a lot. It's going to inform this next talk that I do. And it's really, I don't know, I think it's an interesting thing because, you know, I think I was, and probably still am, one of the more formal and like, here are some hard conclusions that you can draw. Here are some takeaways that you can actually apply type of people. So I'm sort of struggling with this other side of things now. And it's interesting and I feel good about it. But yeah, so this kind of feeds into my next topic, which is about indie game development. You know, what is the life of an indie game developer these days? It's a really weird time. There's so much. The world is so saturated with games, and every market is just like oversaturated with games. And you know, it's one thing to say, well, just make a really great game, make it, you know, something that does something that other people don't do, and it'll naturally sort of rise to the top. And you know, that may be true on some level, maybe. We don't know that that's true, and we don't really have a way of testing that exactly. But I've been thinking, and this kind of goes into the last topic a little bit, you know, what if indie game development, maybe the answer, I went to Play NYC the other day, and I saw a bunch of indies displaying their games, and a lot of their games looked like, you know, they had made them in about a month, maybe 3 months, perhaps some of them 6 months, but nobody for much longer than any of that. And some of them looked like, you know, demos that one could put together in a weekend or two. And yet, here they are in Manhattan with tons of, you know, young people and people from the industry walking through, playing their game. They're talking to them. They're connecting. And they're showing their game to people. And, you know, I've just been kind of thinking, like, maybe that's kind of the way for indie game developers, designers is. And this is so different from my past perspective, and I'm gonna hedge on this a little bit because I have two different routes that I'm taking. This is specifically with Dino Farm. I kind of think, you know, we want to build a community and we want to make stuff and we want to get out there. And you know, thinking of games as a little bit more like blog posts. And it's weird because that's like, on one hand, like we don't want to just like make some crappy game in 3 months and then move on to the next thing. We don't want to do that. But we do want to get our stuff out there soon because it's been so long. It's kind of like how I felt with Push the Lane. You know, I desperately wanted to just like get out there and exist again. You know, when you are, you know, now it's been like 2 years since Oro came out even. And we've had these different projects that we've been like sort of trying to do, and they've all been either too big or there's something else wrong with them. And, you know, time just goes by and you just stop existing as a presence, as a company. People forget about your old games. And so it becomes, it's basically the idea that I'm talking about here is like, you know, making games that are more like more frequently. The Patreon has been really good. Streaming has been really good. Doing more of that kind of stuff, working with people, being more. Another thing is that like, I, you know, Push the Lane, the other thing about it was it's really came across to me how important it is to work with other people. And this is another thing that I've, you know, fought against my whole life. It's another antisocial tendency that I have, is to want to do everything myself because I don't trust people. I just don't trust that people are going to make good decisions, that people will get it. And that, you know, so, but at the same time, like, trying to do everything on your own is just, I mean, I would say it's like, especially for strategy games, which are this crazy, you know, weird challenge that, you know, maybe human beings should never have tried to take on or something, at least the way I see it. Strategy games are so hard. And like, you know, one thing that I noticed was with the Push the Lane development process was there was a week or two where I was, you know, building the game and everything, and didn't really have any serious playtesters. And then at one point I got a playtester who was very, very good, very like playtested the hell out of the game and gave me tons of feedback. And like, it was like, oh, now this can actually become a thing. That's when the best work happened, was when I basically had like a partner working with me. And you know, so I'm learning to appreciate that again, this idea of working with others. And these two things kind of go together, because there's this perfectionism kind of idea that we've had, I think, at Dino Farm. Certainly Blake and I both have had for a long time, this idea of like, you know, we're going to have like one shot to get our game out there and it's got to be perfect. Or not, we don't say perfect, but we kind of mean perfect, or like, you know, the practical version of perfect that could exist. As close to perfect as we can get it, more or less. And, you know, it never is that, really. Oro never was perfect at all by any stretch of the imagination. But we did work on it for a very long time, partially because we kept redoing things. And, you know, I like that. That's definitely a factor. So there's these two things kind of go together, the working with other people and the dismissing perfectionism. Both really kind of go really well together, because like, you know, I guess I sort of feel more, a little bit more like, relax, let's make a thing that we think is cool together and don't worry so much about it. And let's just make a thing. If we think it's cool, it'll probably, you know, it'll be have a, as good a chance as anything to work. It probably won't. We, you know, we certainly don't have super high hopes, but, if we're going to be doing this, if we're going to be making games, I think it's like our best shot. And the nice thing is, if something doesn't resonate, we can just kind of move on to the next thing. We have a little bit more flexibility there. And so that's kind of the basic idea that I want to pursue with Dino Farm. But with my own work, I kind of am doing something like that too. I mean, Push the Lane, we'll see how it goes. I'm next topic, and the last topic that I'll talk about today is the specific issues with Push the Lane. Now, the way I see Push the Lane is like, I kind of want it to be like my flagship game, this thing that actually I work on forever. You know, and that just, I keep making better and better and better, kind of like how Riot has League of Legends. I want to have Push the Lane. And, so that's my goal with that. So actually, it's kind of funny, because that is more of a, I guess one way to frame it is, you know, that's going to be more of like a strategy game. And that's going to be this, you know, unknowingly long process. Like I might be working on it for 10 years type of thing, but I'm okay with like taking that on the side as a side thing. Whereas Dino Farm is more of a business and like, you know, I want that to be like rolling and moving forward and existing and stuff. Push the Lane and my own personal stuff has the advantage of I can do other things. I can do talks, which I'm going to do at IndieCade later this year. I can write books. I can write articles. I can make videos, all that kind of stuff. And I can exist. But for Dino Farm to exist, it needs to be making games. I don't, you know what I'm saying? So that's kind of the idea with Push the Lane and with the Dino Farm games going forward. So now I'm going to just talk a little bit about Push the Lane and its current issues. And then I'm going to wrap up. So with Push the Lane, basically I got it to this point where it's like roughly sort of almost as fun as like a roguelike now, I guess. It kind of works on a similar level that like roguelikes work on. There's, you know, randomly spawning monsters. You go around, you fight these golems, you push lanes by pushing back minions. You go back to the shop, you buy items. You get more powerful, you can push lanes better, you can push them all the way in. Bosses come, they're kind of strong. There is a single player elo system that functions. There's actually a lot of app functionality. Like there's this whole deck building system which works. There's, you can unlock cards, you can there's all kinds of stuff you can do. I'm pretty happy about all that stuff. There's characters you can select. There's I think four fully working characters. Okay, all that. So that's really cool. However, the game sucks. No, it's not very fun right now, and that's because it feels like work. And the big reason it feels like work is that it's mostly management right now. And by that I mean you're just like managing these lanes, making sure they're not too pushed, going out, collecting money, buying more things. There isn't a coherent like element tying everything together in the game. And what do I mean by that? Well, there is no core mechanism. I mean, that's not true. There is a core mechanism, but the core mechanism is not well supported right now. The core mechanism of Push the Lane is lane pushing, meaning the system of these like little lines that have minions on them, and you push the minions back, you destroy the towers, and eventually push the lane all the way. That is the lane pushing mechanism. Right now, it's not very supported. And by that I mean, how pushed a lane is doesn't change anything. And not only that, but the pushness of a lane is very transient. So like you may push a lane a bunch and then like one monster comes and suddenly the lane is pushed back in the other direction intensely. So everything is too transient. The lane pushedness doesn't matter enough. And that's the current problems. That's been the problem since I stopped sometime like mid-August. So now let's talk a little bit about possible solutions. The solution that I have in mind is along the lane, there are these little, like sort of plates that, the minions step on, and they're kind of like capture points. They take like three turns to capture or something. So when a minion walks on them, it converts the plate to its color. Attached to the plate is a little like light post, like a street lamp kind of thing. When one of your minions captures one of those street lamps, so the whole map is shrouded in darkness except for around your base. And I'll talk about the darkness and what that means. First of all, darkness is extremely dangerous to walk through. So there's going to be like a really powerful monster that appears in the darkness. So you want to worry about that. Be careful about that. So that's number one. When your minions capture one of these capture points, the lamp lights up and it creates an area, like let's say, I don't know, 6x6, something like that, area, circle of light for your team. And that, you know, pushes the darkness back, obviously. And in light areas, you can build these like sort of lane upgrades. And there's a bunch of different things they might be. They might be things that produce minions. They might be like a special item shop, or they might be a camp that you can go and fight golems in. Or they might be a thing that makes you a little bit stronger in the area. Or they might be a teleporter that teleports you to the base. There's all kinds of things they could be. I'm not sure about those details yet. But this idea does mean that the pushness of the lane kind of matters. And it also means now, and the push plates make the lane pushing a little bit more less transient. So when a lane is pushed to here or there, just the fact that minions have to stop for three turns to capture is going to mean that like towers, that towers mean more, you know, and that how pushed a lane is going to sort of stay more static. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking now. For the big solution, obviously it's going to require testing. I'm not so sure how it'll work out. There are some other ideas being floated around. I'd love to hear your ideas. If you have any thoughts or ideas, if you want to come test out the game, you know, you can become a patron or come by what's it called? If you can't afford to be a patron, come by the, Discord, and I can just PM me and I can probably give you access to the game, 'cause I do want some feedback. So anyways, that's what's going on. I do hope for this podcast to have some more guests in the future. I'm certainly going to have more guests in the future. I have a list of people that I want to get on, some old and some new. I'm not sure if I'm going to have another episode up this month because I have to write this IndieCade speech talk. But very soon again, I will get back to writing articles, doing videos, all that kind of stuff. I'm looking forward to that, getting that back to normal now that this crazy summer is over. And yeah, thank you so much for listening, and I will be back soon. Stay tuned.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.